Marsha Gessen's vivid commentary on her homeland, Russia, over the last 20 years has illuminated a complicated story of failed hopes, crushing political corruption and personal anguish. She's a journalist, most recently director of the Russian Language Service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. She's just quit to write a book about the Boston Marathon bombing suspects. She emigrated with her family from Russia to Boston at the age of 14, so she knows that city well, and she returned to Moscow in 1994. But the book we want to talk about today is her fairly devastating biography of Russian President Putin. It's called The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Marsha Gessen's here for the Auckland Writers and Readers Festival. Hello, welcome.
Hello, great to be here.
I've just been looking at a story about Alexander Litvinenko from Britain. He was the former KGB agent who was killed by polonium. The judge investigating that killing says that the British government's cover-up of vital evidence is making it impossible for him to conduct a fair inquest. Now, I start by asking you about Litvinenko because in a very complicated story, he is in some ways quite a central figure. What's your take on what happened to him?
In fact, I would say yes. In a very complicated story, he is the only simple component.
Yes, I grasp him like a drowning person.
Right. Alexander Litvinenko was a classic whistleblower. He was a KGB officer. From all that I was able to gather about him, an honest KGB officer who at one point decided to mount practically a one-person fight against illegal practices within the KGB, and specifically, well, the FSB, the successor agency to the KGB. This is in the 1990s we're talking about. Specifically, he was talking about assassinations ordered and carried out by the FSB. He claimed at one point to have been given the assignment to assassinate Boris Berezovsky, then a very prominent Russian oligarch and a politician. And there had, in fact, been...
Just let us put Berezovsky's name in our minds, because he's the guy that actually elevated Vladimir Putin.
He played a very important role in it.
Okay.
I wouldn't say he did it single-handedly, but he liked to claim he did it single-handedly. Anyway, but this is the late 1990s, and Berezovsky is friendly with Putin, who becomes head of the security services, the FSB. He actually brokered a meeting between Litvinenko, the whistleblower, and Putin, the head of the FSB. The meeting did not go well, and soon after this, Litvinenko started facing persecution. He was arrested, then released. This sort of thing never happens now, but back then people could sometimes get out of jail once they were in jail. And he fled Russia. He settled in Great Britain, and he became one of the most prominent critics of the Putin regime from the outside. And he knew what he was talking about. He had spent years in the security services. He was involved in investigating, among other things, the apartment building bombings that played a key role in bringing Putin to power. And in 2006, he was assassinated by polonium, which was given to him, from what we can tell, by two men who had been affiliated with the FSB, who had been affiliated with other Russian institutions. One of them is now a member of the Duma, the Russian parliament. And the Russian government has steadfastly refused to extradite him to Britain to face justice. What has been going on in Britain for the last 6 months or so is an inquest, parts of it open, parts of it closed, into the death of Litvinenko.
And who do you think killed him?
Well, he was killed by polonium, which is a highly controlled, highly radioactive substance. No ordinary radioactive poison, but something that is produced in tiny, tiny amounts. And this particular polonium could only have been obtained inside Russia, and has been traced to those two Russians. And it could not have been obtained without the authorization of at the highest level of the Russian government, and I would claim without the authorization of Putin personally. In all the many killings and apparent political assassinations that have marked Putin's rule, this is really the only smoking gun because of the polonium. And the reason there's a smoking gun is because Litvinenko turned out to be an incredibly physically resilient man. He lived much longer with the polonium inside him than anyone might have expected. And so the investigation into what was killing him for 3 weeks was actually underway while he was still alive. And they determined that it was polonium on the last day of his life. Had he died earlier, as expected, they never would have figured out why he died.
Alexander Litvinenko and a journalist who was murdered, Anna Politkovskaya, had both cast doubt on the official version of the Moscow theatre siege of 2002. And you also mentioned those apartment bombings. Hugely public, violent events, the truth of which is almost impossible to ascertain.
Right. This, for me as a journalist, as an investigative journalist, it was an incredibly frustrating book to write in some ways. Because, you know, in the course of normal work for an investigative journalist, you use the resources available to law enforcement. You look at investigations conducted by law enforcement. You look at court transcripts. You look at witness testimony. Almost none of that is available to somebody working in Russia because law enforcement, at the very least, does not properly investigate acts of terror. And at most, and I would claim typically, is complicit in the cover-up of many acts of terror, including the theater siege in which 139 people died, and 129 people died, and nearly 1,000 people were held hostage for 3 days.
And another big story you covered, of course, was the school in North Ossetia, where a group of armed men had taken hundreds of children and parents hostage, 3-day standoff, ending in a catastrophic, and you say unnecessary, storming by troops.
Absolutely. This is, in some ways, this case is different because there was, in fact, an eyewitness. In fact, one of the terrorists was captured, and there was a trial. It was a trial that was held in this little town in North Ossetia, and had it not been for volunteer efforts of people who transcribed the hearings and put them up online, we wouldn't have a lot of detail. As it is, it's actually very well documented. And what emerged in the course of that particular court hearing was that while the siege of the school was going on, at least two different law enforcement agencies, the Federal Security Services and the local police, were working at cross purposes. And when the standoff was almost over, it appears that it was the Federal Security Services that provoked a shootout that led to the storming of the school. And while they stormed the school, they shot at the gymnasium where most of the children were, at point-blank range with, from tanks. And that's where most of the children who died burned alive as a result of that storm.
So back to the character of President Putin then. All these incidents throughout his reign as president, prime minister, point to his apparent need to prove himself to be a man of strength, if not violence. That's his image, right? And that seems to work in Russia, does it?
It worked up until a point. I don't think it's working anymore. And the reason it's not, the fact that it's not working anymore is the reason for the crackdown through which we're living right now. But yes, I mean, Vladimir Putin, who has often been portrayed as a blank slate and as somebody who's extremely closed, has actually told us an awful lot about himself. And, you know, in some ways, this book was very interesting to write because this is an almost unique case of somebody who, before becoming head of state, had no public record. You know, he'd spent his life in the KGB.
Not doing anything very exciting in the KGB either.
Not apparently doing anything very exciting, basically being a paper pusher, a frustrated paper pusher in the KGB. He got to invent himself when he was anointed Yeltsin's successor in late 1999. and while he was running for president when he was already acting president in the winter of 2000. And while he was inventing himself, he gave a series of interviews that, to my mind, are extremely revealing, because it's actually a series of stories about Putin getting into fights, brawls, street fights. Putin as a school child getting into a fight, Putin as a student getting into a fight, Putin as a KGB agent getting into a street brawl. And they always have sort of the same dramaturgy. Putin gets frustrated. Putin gets mad. Putin attacks somebody. Putin seems to calm down. And then he restarts the attack. And this is the portrait of somebody who sees himself in a positive light as a thug and as a vengeful thug who has trouble containing his aggression.
So they appointed him, anointed him, because it looked like he wouldn't cause anybody any trouble.
Or they were so overconfident that they assumed he wouldn't cause anybody any trouble.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't even say it looked like he wouldn't. It's that they just assumed that they would be able to control him. When we say they, what we mean is a very small circle that surrounded ailing and outgoing Russian President Boris Yeltsin. He's a very controversial figure, but certainly no Putin, and basically I would say an organic Democrat. But when he was finishing out his second and final term in office, he had every reason to fear that once the opposition came into office, he would be prosecuted for things that had happened in the 1990s. And so they needed somebody, his small circle known as the family. They needed somebody who would guarantee Yeltsin immunity from prosecution. That Putin did. Yeltsin lived out the rest of his days in peace, just outside of Moscow. But everything else that was assumed by the people who put Putin in power, such as that he would continue Yeltsin's work, that he would remember and be grateful to the people who put him where he was, none of that worked out. And among other things, Boris Berezovsky, the oligarch I mentioned earlier, ended up in exile in London.
I'm interested in the evolution of the relationship between Boris Berezovsky and Vladimir Putin, because, as we said, Boris Berezovsky backed him in the first instance, and he owned a television station, which came in very handy. Around the same time as Putin was on the rise, there was a series of explosions in Moscow and elsewhere, and Chechens were blamed. Berezovsky came to believe that it was the FSB, the subsequent successor to the KGB, trying to terrify people into voting for Putin, who was prime minister at that point and heading for president. Why did Berezovsky change his mind about Putin, or why did Putin change his mind about Berezovsky?
Right. Those are two related but different questions. Berezovsky, I should say, was quite late to come to the conclusion that the security services were behind the apartment bombs.
Yeah, like it took years.
Yes. The last time that I had a long sit-down interview with Berezovsky was 5 years ago. He was just coming around to this view. He was still sort of struggling with it. What happened in August and September of 1999 was a series of apartment building explosions that culminated with an aborted explosion in Rizan, where the FSB basically screwed up, and it became clear that at least the explosion that was aborted in Rizan would have been organized by the FSB. Several independent journalists conducted quite thorough investigations of these apartment bombings. And while it's impossible to get conclusive proof, again, because we lack law enforcement cooperation, there's overwhelming evidence for the claim that these apartment bombings that killed over 350 people in three different cities were organized by the security services. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with why Putin changed his mind about Berezovsky. What that has to do with, I think, is largely what happened when the Kursk submarine sank.
Yeah.
This was quite early in Putin's time in office. This was August 2000, so Putin had been in office for 3 months. And I don't think he had fully come to understand that he was now leader of this huge country. I think he still felt very much sort of the frustrated bureaucrat that he had been his entire life. He mishandled the disaster horribly. He was on vacation in Sochi when the submarine sank.
And stayed on vacation.
And his justification for staying on vacation is that they didn't need a lot of bureaucrats bumping shoulders while people were trying to do their rescue work in the Arctic. He perceived himself very much as a gray little man, as the gray little man that he appeared to be, and not as a leader. And the Russian military mishandled the catastrophe horribly as well. They did not allow international foreign rescue teams into their waters to try to save the 28 men who were stuck in the part of the submarine that continued to be intact. And they may have lived as long as 3 days, those men. There was ample opportunity to try to save them, and none of that was done. The Russian public watched this unfold almost in real time, because at that time there was still quite a lot of independent or quasi-independent television, including Channel 1, which was controlled by Berezovsky. And Putin saw that Channel 1, which had elevated him to power, which had created him, could undo him just as easily, because he appeared to be so ineffectual, so weak, and so incompetent when he saw himself on Channel 1. And Channel 1 also procured an audio tape of a closed meeting that Putin had held with the parents of the men who were at that point still believed to be alive at the bottom of the Arctic Sea. Putin had lost his temper during the meeting. He had screamed at the parents. He had lashed out at the people who he said had destroyed the Russian military, forgetting that he was president of the country that he was criticizing. So Channel 1 played parts of that tape with absolutely devastating commentary. After this, Putin called Berezovsky in and demanded that Berezovsky hand over Channel 1. And that was their falling out. It unfolded very quickly after that. Berezovsky was forced into exile. It was made very clear to him that if he didn't leave the country or if he chose to return, he would immediately go to jail. And he spent the rest of his days in London, really tortured by the desire to return to Russia and to reclaim his place in Russian society. And he died as the result of either suicide or an assassination by hanging in March of this year.
Less than a year after Vladimir Putin took office, as you point out in your book, all three federal television networks were state-controlled. And Channel 1 and then the rest fell. Berezovsky then went from a supporter of Vladimir Putin into someone who was quite happy to see the most damaging criticism of him aired on his television channel. So Berezovsky was a champion of freedom of expression. I mean, you know, Jeremy Scahill said before 9 o'clock that the world is full of double and triple dealers. When it comes to Russia, I mean, how do you know who to believe there?
I don't think I have an answer to that question. I think
everybody's got an agenda, and then people change the agenda. And then there's, you know, a front organization and a back organization and a bluff and a, you know, it's like a game, isn't it?
It is like a game. And it's a country that I think has been devastated by a century of immorality, a century when everything that was said was meant to mean its opposite.
Right.
You know, a century of this upside-down ideology that was also forever changing. I think that has done incredible damage that hasn't been fully described by anyone, and I don't even know really how to approach the job of that particular description. But I think that the only chance that anybody trying to understand Russia, whether inside Russia or outside of Russia, has lies in the diversity of voices and the diversity of opinion. And that is something that Vladimir Putin has destroyed.
You gave a very vivid description of the Russian Spring, which sprang during Gorbachev's glasnost and perestroika, discussion groups and activism and protests with some remarkable women leaders. Where are they now?
They are dead now.
At the hands of?
Oh, we don't know. The book begins with the story of my friend Galina Staravoitova, who was an amazing Russian politician, one of those people who emerged during Gorbachev's perestroika and who played a key role in the early Yeltsin administration. An absolutely brilliant woman who continued to be a fighter in the Russian parliament up until November 1998, when she was assassinated in the stairway of her apartment building. And the reason I start the book with her, even though this happened before Vladimir Putin came to power in Russia, is that that's what led me to his story. Galina was from St. Petersburg, and she was elected from St. Petersburg. So that was her home base. And that was the city whose administration has largely, and whose politics and whose cultural climate had largely been shaped by Vladimir Putin, who had been deputy governor there from 1990 until 1996. And that was a culture of paranoia, of bugs planted in every journalist and every prominent politician's office, and of political assassinations and apparent business assassinations, with people gunned down in broad daylight in the middle of Nevsky Prospekt, the central avenue of St. Petersburg. This is Russia's largest city, and it was living the life that all of Russia would start living once Putin moved from St. Petersburg to the president's chair in Moscow.
So she was assassinated. And what happens in Russia after a figure like that is assassinated? Is there an investigation that anybody believes in? Are there reports in newspapers? What happens?
There's certainly reports in newspapers, and there's an investigation, and that's where we get into trouble, because of all the killings of politicians and journalists in Russia in the last dozen years, or actually in the last decade and a half, and there have been many, none, not one, has been conclusively solved. There are a few cases in which the hard hand, and this is the case of with Staravoitova, this is also possibly the case with Anna Politkovskaya, the person believed to have pulled the trigger, the person who was hired to kill, that person has sometimes faced a trial and gone to jail. And that's a minority of cases. But in none of the cases has the actual contractor, the person who did the hiring, who wanted the killing, in none of the cases has that person been identified and brought to justice.
So it's a kind of a climate that has been created whereby people know that certain people can be killed with impunity.
I think that's the best way of putting it. And, I just had an argument last week with a very well-known editor of a radio station in Moscow. And he was saying, look, stop calling Putin a bloody executioner. And I said, well, of course he's a bloody executioner. Look at all the people who have been executed. And his argument was Putin didn't personally order those executions. He might say, take care of such and such, or God, when will someone finally take care of so and so? My argument is Putin has created an entire system in which a fairly large category of people, including journalists and politicians and other critics of the regime, fall outside the protection of the law. It's open season on them. If you want to kill a journalist or a politician who is in the opposition, you can do it, and you can do it with impunity. And for that, I call him a bloody executioner. My interlocutor said, well, that's a question of political responsibility, not personal responsibility. I think when you're president, you bear personal responsibility for everything that happens in your country, especially when people are killed.
I'm talking to Marcia Gessen, author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Is this book available in Russia?
It's not at the moment. The book has been translated into something like 20 languages, but not into Russian. I have had interest from small publishers, but I wanted to share the risk of having the book out in Russian with a larger publisher, somebody who won't fold when they come under attack. And the larger publishers have been quite open with me by saying that they know they will be shut down if they put the book out.
You know, despite all this, the case against Vladimir Putin, if you like, he still remains popular, does he not?
No, he doesn't. I mean, let's look at the numbers critically. He claimed on March 4th of last year to have garnered 63% of the vote. Now, we know that that was an unfounded claim. But independent exit polls, two separate ones that were quite well conducted from what I can tell, show that he got roughly 50% of the vote, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more, across the country. That sounds like a lot, until you consider the fact that he had a monopoly on the media and a monopoly on the ballot. So nobody was on the ballot who wasn't put there by Putin, and nobody who was on the ballot campaigned. So what we're actually looking at is 50% protest vote. None of the people who voted for one of the other candidates did it because they wanted to or hoped to see that person in office. They were voting against Putin. So with a complete monopoly on the media, he gets a 50% protest vote. That's huge. That means that if there were a fair and open election in Russia, not just with an honest vote count, but with equal access to the media for different candidates, and with the opening up of public space for actual campaigning, he would get a minority of the vote. Maybe he would get 25%, I don't know, but probably not more than that. That's not a lot of popular support for a president.
I think you make the point. You went on the road with Garry Kasparov when he was trying to get political traction. And I guess if he had had fair access to the media. And you described the harassment he had when he was travelling, you know, mysterious hotel bookings suddenly cancelled. If he had had a fair run, he might have got somewhere?
I think, you know, I was quite taken with the Kasparov story when 8 years ago he declared that he was leaving chess and entering politics. Because I thought, you know, if anybody can do it, he can do it. Not that he could have become Russia's president. He is Jewish and Armenian and speaks Russian with a slight accent. So he had no chance in a xenophobic country like Russia of being elected president. But he did have a chance of being heard because he has incredible credibility. He is very popular. You know, he's a household name throughout Russia. People know he is very smart. People have reason to trust him. He is an incredible public speaker, just relentlessly logical, very approachable, very energetic. He's got incredible charisma. He has a lot of money. He had the money to finance going around Russia and speaking to people everywhere. What he couldn't get was an actual audience. Everywhere we went, and this was his first attempt at a large sort of speaking tour. We went to the south of Russia. He chartered a plane. They'd booked large spaces in every city where we're supposed to be. Those spaces would be mysteriously shut down when we got there. So he would be reduced to speaking to people on the sidewalk. But of course, you know, immediately some sort of wind orchestra would show up or a boombox, and the loud music would drown out Kasparov's voice. They would also start closing off the sidewalks by staging, you know, people, children's drawing, sidewalk drawing competitions. By the end of the trip, we couldn't get a hotel room or a restaurant meal or a meeting with anybody that he'd planned to meet with. He was planning to meet with local leaders and business leaders, and they would get harassed out of meeting with
him.
You're
describing a country in which conspiracy theory is real. You know,
right,
yeah,
I might be paranoid,
but right. It doesn't mean that. You know, it all sounds like a Kafkaesque nightmare.
It does, and it is. And it is a terrible thing to live through. As much as we try to create little safe spaces for ourselves, when I say we, I mean, you know, people who are opposed to Putin's politics and people who want to talk to other sane people, it's getting harder and harder. As I said, for the last year, we've been in the midst of an all-out crackdown.
Why are you still alive? I mean, you said you've made your point that your existence and your work belie your argument that working as a journalist in Russia is virtually impossible, but there you are, doing it. Does that not undermine your case?
I hope it doesn't. I'm not ready to die for it. I think that publicity in the West has been good protection for me. When I was reporting and writing the book, I kept it absolutely secret. And my editor was even banned from mentioning it by name in our correspondence. It was called The Russia Book. When I interviewed people for the book, I would tell them that I was reporting a book on Russian politics. So I would go very far afield in the conversations to try to show that I wasn't interested in just in Putin. The time that it would have made the most sense to get rid of me was when I was still reporting the book, to prevent the book from coming out. Once the book was out to major publicity in the West, I was under some protection. It's not foolproof. I think that my existence is risky, but there are other people who don't have the kind of attention from the West, who don't live in Moscow, who are being beaten up, harassed, and assassinated as we speak. You know, people working in Sochi, for example, people working in Dagestan, which is also part of Russia, as many people tend to forget, who routinely get kidnapped, for whom, the risk of assassination is a daily part of their job.
You have a family.
I do.
And do you go to extra measures to make sure that they're safe?
Well, my oldest son, who's 14, is going to leave the country this summer and not come back, because I think that the risk to him is too significant. So he's going to boarding school in the States.
I want to ask you a couple of personal questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You described Russia as xenophobic. Is it also homophobic? You're gay.
Russia is becoming more homophobic by the minute. Part of the crackdown that I have mentioned has involved the passage of laws against what they call homosexual propaganda.
Yes, I see the parliament's getting ready to pass a bill to that effect.
Yes. But
what's homosexual propaganda?
Well, that's a good question. Homosexual propaganda, I hope you forgive this legalese quote, is defined as the uncontrolled and goal-directed distribution of information that may harm the spiritual or physical development of children, including forming in them the erroneous impression of social equality, of traditional and non-traditional marital relations. This is an amazing piece of legislation, and this has been passed all over the country locally, and it's about to be passed on the federal level. This is legislation that actually enshrines in law social inequality. It makes it an offense to claim social equality. If I tell my kids that we're just the same as the family next door, I commit a crime.
Is there anybody in public life, apart from Anton Krasovsky, who's just announced on live television that he's gay and caused a huge sensation, is there anybody beside him who's come out as gay?
I'm glad to have company, because for years I was the only person who was publicly out in the country.
But did you ever stand up and say it, or did you just not mention it?
Oh no! I've always stood up and said it. I'm the talking head on every television or radio show about gay and lesbian issues in Russia, and I have been for 20 years.
That must be an uncomfortable position to hold in such a country, then.
I find keeping secrets more uncomfortable than speaking out. It hasn't always been pleasant, but I dislike the alternative even more. There have been actually a number of people who have come out. That's the positive effect of this law, if a law like this can have a positive effect. a number of Russian publications, the remaining independent publications, of which there aren't many, have published pieces where people have come out. Dozens of people have said that they want to declare publicly that they're gay because of this homophobic law. And Russian liberals have finally been forced to take a position on LGBT rights, which they had steadfastly avoided doing before.
So what's going to happen to Anton Krasovsky? Because he was editor-in-chief of a new Kremlin-funded internet broadcaster. He announced that he was gay on live television, and he is now unemployed.
And he believes himself to be unemployable. He has been unemployed for a few months. I think this happened in February. And he says, yeah, he can't get a gig. I think that it's partly because he did work for the Kremlin. So he's in an interesting position in that sense. But yeah, it's he's not going to get, obviously, any kind of work on a state channel. And the one independent television channel perhaps doesn't want to hire somebody whose claim to fame is having been fired from a Kremlin channel for coming out.
No. And as you describe it, there's hardly going to be a groundswell of public opinion to try to reinstate him or in support of him.
Exactly.
Another personal question. You wrote a book called Blood Matters about your family and genetics, and you will have taken a personal interest in the revelation that Angelina Jolie has had a double mastectomy, will you not?
Yes. I had my own preventive double mastectomy almost 8 years ago. So
for the same reason?
For the same reason. In fact, I have the exact same mutation. Yes, and I wrote about it, both in a series of articles on Slate and then in a book that's much more broadly about medical genetics, but it also contains my personal story. And I'm very happy to see somebody as high profile as Angelina Jolie and as much of a sex symbol as Angelina Jolie come out and talk about this. It's a very, very important topic.
Yeah, somebody was describing to me, they were listening foolishly to Talkback Radio here the other night, and they were describing to me the conversation that went on it, where it was two or three blokes, and they were saying, you know, some people will do anything for publicity, won't they? And I thought, what on earth are they thinking? How long was your thought process before you made that decision, radical decision?
Well, when I first learned that I had the mutation, first of all, my mother died of breast cancer before her 50th birthday. My great aunt died of ovarian cancer at the age of 52. So I'd seen people very close to me suffer and die at a very early age. And this is when somebody goes and gets tested for these mutations, that's usually the background they bring to this decision-making process. You've been living with the fear and the images for years and years. So when I learned I had the mutation, I realized first that I couldn't absorb information connected to it. And this was a long time ago, almost 10 years ago. So there wasn't a lot of public conversation about it. It was still pretty new science and pretty new process of decision making. So what I decided to do ultimately was write a series of articles in which I would interview different experts and then make a decision to help me process the information. So I pitched the series to Slate. They were very enthusiastic about it. I wrote an 8-part series that involved talking not only to oncologists and to cancer counselors and to survivors, but also to an economist. We tried to create an economic model of for calculating the benefits of having surgery, not having surgery. And ultimately, the editor tried to let me off the hook and said, you don't have to make a decision. You don't have to announce it in the last installment of the series. I was like, no, that was the point. The point was to hold me to the obligation of making a decision. So I made the decision to have a double mastectomy and not have my ovaries removed, which is an important part of my story.
Why did you choose not to have your ovaries removed?
Because I believe, and my research showed, that had much more significant consequences, both health-wise and lifestyle-wise, than I was willing to face. Once a woman has her ovaries removed, once she goes through surgical menopause, her risk of heart disease shoots way up, risk of high blood pressure, stroke. There are mental health consequences, extremely high risk of depression, sleep disturbance, cognitive impairment, loss of libido. I am not willing to trade all of that for peace of mind on ovarian cancer. I am engaged in aggressive surveillance of ovarian cancer. It's pretty unreliable. But I think that the other health consequences are unacceptable to me. And I actually am very much hoping that Angelina Jolie's coming out as a mutation carrier will lead to some conversation on this topic, which I think is sorely lacking.
Yeah, well, apparently it is, and it will. And as you say, it's... would you describe it as a brave thing she's done or a perfectly rational response to a risk?
I think that the surgery is perfectly rational. And look, having your breast removed, I mean, it's traumatic, but every study that of people who have done this, and there have now been a significant number, shows that generally women are happy with the decision. The reconstruction generally is fairly high quality. The peace of mind you get in exchange for this is priceless. And there are no physical consequences to having your breasts removed. They serve no biological function, as far as we know, outside of breastfeeding. So that's a very sane, very rational decision. What I think is brave is talking about it publicly.
Yeah. One more question. Back to Russia. What is your informed prognosis?
Oh, I don't know that I'm a very good prognosticator. While the protest movement was going on, and it hasn't died off, but it's been largely suppressed, I was very hopeful. I really felt like Putin didn't have more than a couple of years left in him. I have a lot less hope now, because what Putin has done is he's chosen to go the crackdown route, which I think was predictable. Many people believed, however, that he might opt for soft reform, for changing the system from within, and that we would face a fairly quick and soft transition. But the experience of 20th century dictators shows that the crackdown guarantees longer staying power than soft reform, even though soft reform may look better. He's going for an all-out crackdown, so things will get a lot worse before they get better.
Is it possible to be a journalist in Russia without being an activist? You are both, I think.
I am both, although when I have had jobs requiring me to report or to supervise reporting on political issues, I have not engaged in political activism. I was very lucky to be running a popular science publishing house at the time of the protest movement, so I could, with an absolutely clear conscience, actually participate in the organizing. But I left my organizing activities as soon as I went back to political reporting.
And a very interesting incident occurred when you lost your job because you refused to cover Vladimir Putin's flight with the cranes or something. And for the first time you met him, he offered to get you your job back. What's that?
When Vladimir Putin likes something, he thinks he owns it. He liked the magazine I edited, which I'm not sure is a compliment, and he thought he owned it. He thought the job was his to offer back to me, and you know that's true of a lot of Russian publications. A lot of editors in chief are appointed directly by the Kremlin. But yeah, what happened was that my brilliant idea was that I was going to work on this popular science publishing house, and popular science is my other journalistic passion outside of politics. And that this was going to be a great place to sit out the political undoing of the Putin regime. And then that worked fine until I got a phone call from my publisher asking me to send somebody to cover Vladimir Putin hang gliding to lead the Siberian cranes on a migratory route. And, you know, my position wasn't particularly brave. I said, look, if we send somebody, we're going to see something go wrong. It always does. Some animal always gets hurt on these things. We're a popular science magazine. We don't have to cover Putin. Let's just pretend we don't know about this and do a story on the Siberian cranes, which I have assigned, without Putin. And my publisher said, no, you have to send somebody. And if they see something bad, that we don't publish it. And I said, well, that we can't do. We'll be ethically obligated to cover it. So he fired me on the spot.
And then you got a phone call.
And then I got a phone call. And then Putin's, and I thought it was a joke. I thought this was going to go on YouTube. But in fact, it was Putin personally. He said he'd read that I had been fired and he'd unwittingly served as the reason for it. And he said he wanted to meet with me and tell me about his nature preservation efforts and the fact that he was sincere. And we met. And he was exactly the person I described in the book. He was just as two-dimensional and cartoonish and flat. As I'd said, he was also amazingly poorly prepared for the meeting. He had not been briefed. He didn't know about the book. He didn't know I was an American citizen. He didn't know anything about me, which I think is a really good indication of just how dysfunctional and disorganized the Russian government has become. And he offered me my job back, and I ended up writing a piece and writing a letter to my publisher saying that, you know, that I couldn't be appointed to my job by Vladimir Putin.
Nice story, though. Marsha Gessen. Thank you. Marsha Gessen is the author of a book called The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. And she is appearing at the Auckland Writers and Readers Festival.